Hello and welcome to the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Renee Kemp, guest hosting today for vacationing Rose Aguilar. So glad you could join us on a day when so much is happening in the news. It's a great time to hear from journalists, a host of topics. At the top of that list, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleads guilty. And in a recent development that's being reported, apparently candidate Donald Trump directed Flynn to make contact with the Russians. That's a bombshell development. That controversial tax bill that moved with lightning speed, with no committee hearings through the Senate, poised to make a move toward ratification. Sexual harassment claims claimed Matt Lauer this week. What's next? And what about the coverage of those claims? Then we have President Trump retweeting fake anti-Muslim videos. What is the coverage here and abroad on that issue? Then there's the losing battle for net neutrality. And how about all the companies that are now just gobbling up more and more media outlets? There's so much to talk about this week, and I feel very, very fortunate to be able to guest host this week because we're going to be talking to three reporters who are also media analysts. They watch these things carefully, and I'm looking forward to hearing from them, starting with Richard Gisberg. Richard is the creator. I'm sorry, I've just been corrected. I'm starting with Andy Kroll. Andy Kroll is an investigative reporter for Mother Jones based in Washington, D.C., and he's a contributing writer for the California Sunday Magazine. Hi, Andy.
Great to be here.
Hi, Craig Aaron is here too, president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund, which are devoted to changing media and technology policy and promoting public interest and strengthening democracy. Hello, Craig.
Hi, thanks for having me back on the show.
You bet. And once again, welcome from Al Jazeera English, the weekly media critique and analysis show. Mr. Gisberg, thanks for being here. Okay, we'll catch up with him later. Let's start with Andy Kroll of Mother Jones. With these developments, Andy, on the Michael Flynn case, it appears, according to ABC News reporting, that perhaps as part of a plea deal, the former National Security Advisor is pointing toward candidate Donald Trump, saying that he directed Flynn to make contact with the Russians. Andy, how significant of a development do you think this is?
Well, I think the fact of the Flynn news today, the Flynn indictment alone, is pretty significant. I, you know, personally want to wait to see more confirmation about this bit of news that I believe ABC's Brian Ross has put out about whether candidate Trump directed Flynn to contact the Russians. I mean, obviously, if that is true, it's a huge piece of news. Kind of blows the whole thing wide open. But setting that aside for the moment, you know, just the indictment itself today of the former national security advisor to the president is huge news, and it's, you know, a sign that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, is, you know, proceeding apace with his work and his team's work, and this thing, it looks like it has a long way to go.
Well, in terms of the coverage of all of this, to what extent do you think the media kind of got out in front of this, this news? Because it seems to me that this kind of thing has already been, at the very least, hinted at before in some coverage. Is that your take as well?
In terms of the Michael Flynn indictment you're talking about today?
Yes. And and the possible connection with directions from Donald Trump as a candidate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's been, you know, an unbelievable amount of writing and reporting on who might have said what and the potential contacts with Russians. I mean, I think that the news today from Michael Flynn, this is, you know, hard evidence, and this is a serious new, you know, place on the chronology, on the timeline, of, if you will, of what the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration was doing with relation to the Russians and, you know, the Russian ambassador, former Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak as well. I mean, in terms of the specific news today, you know, Special Counsel Mueller keeps his cards extremely close to his vest, and by all indication runs an incredibly tight ship. So we don't know about, us in the media don't know about the kind of thing like this with Flynn, really, until it happens. There are little hints here and there. But, you know, we all learned about it this morning when the news of the indictment came down.
Well, certainly Mother Jones has been all over this. So if you haven't heard what the next shoe to drop might be, then I guess nobody does. So, Craig, Aaron, do you have a take on today's developments in the Michael Flynn case?
Well, you know, mostly I'm just sitting here with my popcorn waiting to see what happens next. I think, as an outside observer, you know, what seems to be really notable is, you know, with this, you know, what appears to be a plea deal and a small set of charges when there are a whole lot of allegations, which would suggest that, you know, Flynn is talking and Flynn is maybe rolling over on people higher up the food chain. And, you know, I'm just here as a, you know, private citizen hoping they hurry up.
Well, you know, once again, this unfolded as I was, you know, waking up this morning as Americans turned on their TV sets. And it's just incredible. So I certainly wanted to start with that. But it's our tradition here at the Media Roundtable to just ask you what's the best news coverage you've seen for the week. So let's back up and do that before we move forward with some of the other things that are happening in the news. Andy, do you have a kudos for good coverage this week?
I do, and it's a piece of journalism that appeared in the New York Times that I will say has stuck with me in a way that I never thought a story about tax policy, that, you know, dry subject that, you know, usually puts us to sleep. But, you know, in yesterday's New York Times, there was a story by Peter Goodman, and the title, at least as it ran online, was, quote, "It started as a tax cut, now it could change American life." This was just a superb piece of journalism about the ongoing debate over this tax legislation here in Washington. You know, what has been euphemistically billed as quote-unquote tax reform really is just a massive tax cut, completely engineered by Republicans, completely put together in the dark without, you know, really even telling us, you know, at least right now with the Senate, what is actually in the bill itself. Yet this bill touches on health care, it touches on education, obviously it touches on the income and the well-being, you know, basic bread and butter issues of Americans across the spectrum. As we've seen, it would add, in the Senate version, you know, $1 trillion to the deficit over a decade-long or so period. I mean, this is a hugely, 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 cannot say hugely enough. I know I'm sounding like Trump here, but a hugely influential piece of legislation that is just being rushed through the United States Congress. And I had not seen a piece of journalism that put it all together in one place, in plain English, you know, with the outrage just barely beneath the surface at what this bill would do, than this piece that was in the Times by Peter Goodman.
It was tremendously, hugely important, to quote Mr. Trump. But because of its importance, I'm just wondering if it's too little, too late. Craig Aaron, one of your companies, one of your agencies, center missions is to strengthen democracy. And that means you've got to have an informed electorate, an informed public. So do you think that the media has done enough to explain this bill? People I talk to, their eyes are kind of glazing over about the whole thing in a way that didn't happen with health care. People were mobilized around that. Has the media done enough to explain this bill?
Well, I think it's a real challenge for the press. I mean, my short answer would be no, although there is a lot of good reporting, as Andy points out. I think one of the real challenges is just how fast-moving this is. I mean, literally, the people voting on it haven't read the bill. You know, let alone there being any space or time for the press to really sink their teeth and explain it. I think that, you know, if you want to follow this, there's a lot of good reporting, and there are a lot of things being lifted up by, you know, how this would actually be a tax increase on so many Americans, all the things happening with student loans and other items, and really just this giveaway, this redistribution of wealth up to the top of the food chain, and all the benefits for big companies. That story is out there if you want to hear it, but you know, so much of the, you know, sort of mainstream TV coverage is a little bit more who's up, who's down politically. Can Trump get this through? Can this Congress function? And probably not quite enough what this really means for you and your paycheck. And I think, you know, tax policy, not unlike healthcare policy, is so or media policy for that matter, tech policy is so complicated that it's hard for, you know, someone coming home from a long day of work to want to sort their way through the tables and percentages and all of that involved in tax policy. And here I'm really only speaking for myself. And so really laying out what's at stake and what this is going to mean really matters. And I don't think we really had that conversation or debate, which is why I don't think this Congress is hearing as much as they did in some of these other debates that happened over months and months and months, and people had opportunities to catch up and get informed and really understand what's at stake. The strategy here, not totally successful yet, but getting close, is to just push this through so fast that no one will know what's happened until it's far too late, and until they start talking about all the things they need to cut now that they gave this massive, massive giveaway.
It's amazing. Anybody you want to give a thumbs up to before we proceed?
Sure. And I spent most of my week really deep in net neutrality, but I think the story that broke through for me appeared on Monday, and it was the Washington Post, and it was this reverse sting operation they ran against James O'Keefe. And this woman who had come to them purporting to be someone who was a victim of Roy Moore, Judge Moore in Alabama, but seemed to be making false accusations and faking it. And the Post ended up running a pretty elaborate reverse sting against the people trying to fool them. And it makes for an amazing story. And I think, you know, did a great job of really going deep and putting the pieces together on what was being tried to be done to the Post, even going so far as putting what were alleged to be off-the-record conversations back on the record because they were, you know, being put forward falsely. So it's an amazing story, and they keep digging and finding more and more about these attempts to infiltrate journalism groups. We know about the previous attempts to infiltrate activist groups, try to get people on camera saying things that they can try to use against them, and the Post just did an amazing job of turning that right around and exposing how it was being done.
And it kind of pulled back the curtain on how journalists do their jobs. It's it was really, I think, expository when you talk about journalists at the Washington Post having been snookered or potentially snookered. I thought it was just amazing that the stingers got stung. And what about the calls around in Alabama, allegedly from the Washington Post, offering to pay people to come out and make statements about Roy Moore? I think the name they came up with, "Hi, I'm Bernie Bernstein from the Washington Post." It just hit me that it was so ham-handed that maybe it was easier to catch that. But I can see where if the Washington Post journalists hadn't been doing their jobs, this could have been a real minefield, don't you think, Andy?
Without a doubt. It's part of our jobs now. I mean, I say this both in the broader sense and also as someone who has had several run-ins with James O'Keefe and has written about O'Keefe and his Project Veritas organization several times in the past. You've got to be more diligent and prepared and cautious and skeptical than ever, not only of the people that you're interviewing for stories that you're doing, the reporting you're doing, the documents you're reviewing, but people who come to you with supposed tips or scoops. I mean, that is, you know, a critical part of our job is readers coming to us, people out in the world coming to us. But you've got to be more on your toes than ever about that. And you know, if I were to give a close second for stories of the past week, I would side with Craig and put that Post story up there. It's, I mean, that story, and especially the video in there of Stephanie McCrummon, the great Post reporter, basically interrogating this undercover Project Veritas operative, is a masterclass in interviewing and really interrogating someone for a story. And so it was sort of fist pumping moment for us in the media to read that story or watch that video. And the Post really did incredible work there.
That video did my heart such good. It was like, yes. And once again, this woman was videotaped going into Project Veritas's headquarters. Of course, that's the organization where undercover operatives dressed up like pimps and prostitutes and went into an Acorn office and successfully brought Acorn down. So the fact that they actually did this kind of digging, and it wasn't even that hard. I mean, you know, they did the work that all good journalists do. But it's not even like this organization, Project Veritas, did a lot to cover their tracks. It's almost like they really underestimated what journalists, good journalists, do, right? Craig?
Yeah, they thought they could. And, you know, but, you know, you're the Post reporters are the best in the business. And we continue to see that as Project Veritas dribbles out these supposed sting videos. What you see is journalists being fair, being skeptical, being modest about what they know and what they don't, and doing their jobs, even in supposedly private conversations with what I assume was an individual who posed as a student or someone looking for a job, but really was this undercover operative.
Especially in the toxic soup of conversation out there about fake news, it was even more important, I think, for people to see what journalism really looks like when it's being done. I just want to invite the callers who are probably very anxious to weigh in on some of these stories to give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Talk, or you can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Speaking of fake news, there was a series of, I believe, four videos that were generated by a fascist group in the UK that was retweeted by President Trump this week. And it led to a real firestorm in Great Britain and a real back and forth between Theresa May and Donald Trump. So, Greg, talk a bit about the local or national coverage versus the international coverage of this dust-up. It appears that the U.K. was more angry about this than the U.S. public was. Is that your take?
Well, I think that's a fair take, you know, partly because I think folks in the UK are familiar with this organization. You know, it's for people, I think really across the political spectrum, based on the reading I've done and the social media I've followed on this story, you know, this is sort of the equivalent of, you know, the president tweeting something like, "Hey, I found this really interesting KKK pamphlet and I'd like to share it with you." You know, so this sort of really set off alarms, you know, throughout the country, and really, you know, not just among progressives or liberals. You know, there was real outrage, and I think, you know, what you're seeing in the States is, you know, certainly got covered, but there's sort of a narrative going of like, oh, there goes Trump tweeting again. That it's hard to keep perspective on, you know, the gravity of just what that means, to have the president getting up every morning to attack his enemies, but, you know, occasionally start saber-rattling with North Korea. And then, you know, it's Tuesday, and oh, here we go. Now we have some tweets about a racist group from England. And, you know, things are moving so fast, you know, even going back to think about, you know, what should the story be this week? You know, it feels like some of these things happened months ago, and it's, you know, maybe been 48 hours. So I think right now so much is happening, and we have a whole new wave with Michael Flynn this morning, that it's people are just having a hard time catching their breath. There's so many outrageous things that you almost lose track of them.
But isn't that the danger, Andy Kroll? Isn't that exactly what some media observers have been saying from the very beginning? And I think that the analogy was, it's like drinking from a fire hose. There is so much coming at you from this president all the time, every day, sometimes two or three times a day. out-and-out lies. I remember when this first began, and we were sitting around the editorial table wondering whether to use the L word. Should we say that these are lies? It was so, such a subtle thing. And now, bigotry, hatred, lies, the outrage seems to be disappearing. Isn't that the danger of us losing our outrage, Andy?
Well, I think it's human nature that you can't keep up that the outrage for day after day, hour after hour, in response to every tweet, every use of a racist term like Pocahontas, as the president did the other day, with an audience of Navajo code talkers and war veterans, I would add, as well. It's just human nature, you know, and it's, I think, for speaking as a journalist, I think it's our job to both contextualize the information as best as we can so that people can maybe know whether this is something that they need to really dip into the reserve of outrage for. I think that these videos are pretty high up there. You know, I would note that these videos, there was some early coverage, in the newspapers of Trump retweeting these videos, and the coverage sort of said that this was, out of the ordinary, or, it was kind of all the sort of oblique language that you used to see in newspapers 20, 30 years ago was striking that he did this. But as the coverage developed, people kind of clued into the fact that this is not the right language, and you started to see, this is completely unprecedented. No one has ever done this. No president has ever behaved this way. And so I think the coverage caught up with how just plain nuts this was, that the president was tweeting these videos to tens of millions of people. And I think for us, in the media, we have to get up every time that the president does something like this, and you have to put it in context, and you have to call it for what it is. Trump has really forced journalists to call something exactly what it is, and not sugarcoat it, and not cloak it in metaphor or analogy or anything like that, but to really confront the issue. And these videos that he shared were just another example of that. We seem to have one every day at this point.
Craig, you're the president of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. Is there any precedent for this anywhere in the world where faith in the media and journalism and the free press is undermined by calling it fake, and there is an onslaught of then fake news that the media is then challenged to cover? Has this ever happened before? And if so, what was the response? Did it work?
Wow, that's a big question, and I think that there are certainly, I don't know if we've ever seen this version of it, or certainly this version of it in a democracy. I think that's pretty unusual, and maybe Andy will come up with some other examples, but I think these kind of actions and behaviors are absolutely the way dictatorships like to work. Find your favorite media outlets or your state-owned media outlets, push your narratives through those, confuse the whole issue. Certainly, some of this would not be uncommon in, sort of the obvious example, Russia, in some of the media and the way the media is treated. Making the media the enemy has been tried and true throughout the world. To be fair, in the United States, nothing new for politicians trying to score points by attacking journalists, but there's no question that under this administration, it has gone to a new level. To have things coming straight from the president, to have these kind of attacks on journalists, or sort of the appearance of urging attacks on journalists, and this just constant battle over what's real and what's fake, and the very different narratives being pushed by allegedly independent outlets that are not critical of the White House, your Fox Newses, your Sinclairs, which I'm sure we'll talk about, are pushing really an alternate reality I was seeing some things flying over social media this morning where, the networks and even CNN and others, of course, were breaking in with the Michael Flynn news, and, the scroll running on Fox was talking about Hillary Clinton. And that's sort of become the new reality, and we haven't seen that here you know, at this volume and this speed, I think it is different, and I do think it's very dangerous.
Which ultimately really challenges journalists to become journalists with a capital J. There's still a lot more ground to cover. As you mentioned, Craig, media consolidation, the Sinclairs gobbling up more local stations, the Koch brothers buying Time magazine, lots to get to. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on today's show. On the phone by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, you can call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. More on the week's news coming ahead on 1A here on KLW at 11. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Your Call Radio and the Friday Media Roundtable. It's a great time to talk with folks who are on the front lines of journalism in times like these. Joining us, Andy Kroll, an investigative reporter for Mother Jones based in Washington, D.C. He's contributing writer for the California Sunday magazine as well. And also Craig Aaron. Craig is president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. They're both devoted to changing media and technology policy, as well as promoting the public interest and strengthening democracy. So glad to have you both here. And coming up on Monday, we hope you'll join us on the next Your Call. We'll have a conversation with renowned author and architect Carl Anthony about the racial history of urban design. He's uniquely positioned to knit both of those worlds together. That's coming up on Monday on Your Call. And we hope you'll join us for this conversation today. For the Media Roundtable, 866-798-8255 is the number. Let's talk sexual harassment coverage, gentlemen. Who would have thought on the last Friday Media Roundtable that on this week's Media Roundtable, we would be talking about Matt Lauer being the most recent one to fall to this kind of sexual harassment charge? Did either of you hear any rumblings? Apparently there were rumblings. Did it come as a surprise to you, for example, Andy Kroll?
Well, any of these, I shouldn't say any, a lot of these reports that have come out concern individuals in media, in politics, in other industries that there had been rumors swirling around for years, decades in some cases. But obviously when you are presented with the story itself, the allegations itself, it's hard not to feel that initial pang of shock or surprise in some cases. But I mean, with Matt Lauer, the crumbs were there in the past that the Today Show set was quote unquote a boys' club, as had been reported around the time of former co-host Ann Curry's departure from the show. I remember that was a very controversial episode for the Today Show, and I believe Curry cited that very phrase, a boys' club, around it. You know, I think that Katie Couric, I believe, had said in the past as well that Matt Lauer would pinch her on the behind. So, you know, and it would taken in isolation in that moment, you know, it's obviously it makes you sit back and think, whoa, what he did what? But then you sort of move on, and it's this isolated sort of moment there. So I think that there were indications in the past that maybe there was a toxic culture in the Today Show at NBC that Matt Lauer had a role in, obviously as the face of the show for so long. But anytime these reports come out and you see the actual detail, and you know, Lauer's case, the the button under his desk to lock the door from the inside and other kinds of details in these pieces by Variety in the New York Times, you're shocked, your eyes get really wide, you keep reading and you're appalled at what you're reading.
Yeah, those charges were pretty smarmy. The button under the desk kind of gave me the creeps. But I must admit, I was shocked at the rate at which they got out the hook. They had this conversation with an employee, apparently a current employee, Monday night. By Tuesday morning, he was out of there. Craig, does that surprise you, Craig Aaron?
Well, in some ways, it pleasantly surprises me that a lot of media organizations and even in Hollywood were starting to see. Obviously, you know, there were probably a lot more people that knew what was going on who haven't spoken out or hadn't connected the dots or hadn't listened to earlier complaints. And I think a lot of that's come out in a lot of these stories. But we are seeing this societal change where there, at least in those places, it hasn't quite extended to the political sphere yet. But in these companies, they're not slowing down as this emerges. Now, I think we can learn from that that there's a change happening, and I can think we are also learning very often that there's a lot more behind this, and there have been a lot of stories and complaints and conversations and folks who knew what was happening, and now we're finally seeing that shift, which I think is a good shift. And I think, you know, based on everything that I hear and read, this is certainly not going to be the last one of these stories to break. And I think there's a lot more coming.
Charlie Rose, gone. Mark Halperin, gone. Again, they get out the hook so fast, but arguably it might be because these media outlets think that they may have some exposure, legal exposure, for having known and covered up some of this. At least that's my take about why they're moving so quickly, yes?
I would have to agree. I think that, you know, the lawyers, once the lawyers are involved in this, and again, as Andy says, you know, the details that are coming out about the way these places were run, you know, what passed for business as usual at all these companies, the situations women were being put in, whether it was their first day on the job or, you know, they were the other star of the show, are truly unbelievable. And, you know, in some cases, this went on for decades. With people, like, let's remember, Matt Lauer was making $25 million a year. Powerful people at companies, huge investments in these personalities. You know, Fox News, we were almost forgotten about those guys, but, you know, they were spending, you know, that much money and more to settle these cases. So, I think overall, obviously, I think this is a very good thing that this is finally seeing the light of day, but it is really almost unbelievable at just how pervasive this kind of sexual harassment and attacks and other things were in all of these institutions.
Well, having said that, I think it's interesting, Andy Kroll, that your organization, Mother Jones, was quick to come to the defense of David Korn, their high-profile investigative reporter around allegations of sexual harassment dating back to 2014. You want to discuss how your outlet handled that charge?
Yeah, by all indications, handled it professionally and thoroughly. That's what the story indicates. I mean, I didn't have any personal involvement, and all these kinds of issues are handled as they should be, confidentially. But by all indications, and what we've talked about here, and as I think as the story indicated, the higher ups here handled it as best they possibly could, and it was taken care of, and all the appropriate steps were taken.
All right, let's move on to the issue of net neutrality. You know, I've always thought that there is a problem with marketing and labeling this thing. If you just called it open internet, I think people would be paying a lot closer attention to just how important this is. A better name is open internet, but net neutrality is what it's called. It's the principle that internet service providers, ISPs, have to give consumers access to any legal content without favoring some content providers who may be paying them more, while blocking other content for which they might be paid less. And there's certainly been a battle royale to try to protect it. It was put in place in the Obama administration, but it appears the battle to save it or protect it has been lost. The FCC set to do away with it with a vote perhaps later this month. So can you talk, Craig, Aaron, about why the average person should be concerned about this?
Absolutely. And the first thing I'll say is we haven't lost yet. There's still 2 weeks before this vote is going to happen. And for reasons I can explain, this will not be the last word in the net neutrality fight. But net neutrality, like the name or not, is the basic idea. It really just means no discrimination. It means when you go online, you should be able to go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and your phone or cable company can't decide which websites and services are going to work or load the fastest and which won't. And this has been an ongoing fight, you know, going back to 2005. At least that's when I started to get involved in this debate and issue over net neutrality. And, you know, the remarkable thing about this fight is public awareness has actually never been higher. The Federal Communications Commission, an agency many people are not familiar with, has gotten 22 million comments about net neutrality, which is more comments in a public proceeding of really any kind at any agency that's ever happened before. And so you're seeing a situation where the Trump administration is moving to undo a very popular policy. And they've been absolutely inundated. There were more than 500,000 phone calls to Congress that happened between last Tuesday and this week, so including over the Thanksgiving weekend when everybody thinks no one's paying attention. Well, apparently a lot of people were paying attention to net neutrality because it's been off the charts. A lot of members of Congress are reporting getting individually 4,000 or 5,000 phone calls supporting net neutrality and zero supporting the Trump administration. And so we've really seen this incredible public upswell. This is one of the stories that broke through last week. It was the number one trending topic on Twitter. And for an obscure tech policy or a once obscure tech policy issue, it's almost unbelievable. And that's what gives me some confidence that this is just another chapter in this fight. The Trump administration seems to insist on moving to undo these rules despite any evidence, economic or otherwise, that needs to happen. And, you know, I know we're going to be taking them to court. We'll be suing if they continue with this vote. And I think Congress is paying attention in a lot of new ways what they want to do and how they might step in down the line, because they've gotten such an overwhelming public response. You're starting to see even Republicans, like Susan Collins from Maine, a number of people in the House, actually speaking out against what the FCC is doing simply because it is just so unpopular.
Well, Andy, Kroll, apparently Ajit Pai of the FCC, had some help in writing the document that would do away with net neutrality. Do you have, and the FCC is set to vote on the changes on December the 14th. Who helped him write it?
I'm not familiar with who helped him write the policy. Craig, you want to step in? I mean, I obviously have the background for, you know, Pai, why he brought this up and a sort of deregulatory trend. But Craig,
I would say you can see the fingerprints of the telecom industry all over this document. It's basically indistinguishable from the kinds of things that AT&T and Comcast and others have been putting into the record for many years. It's a very curious document because it's very ideological. I mean, I think that what you're seeing in the Pai administration, and this is relevant to net neutrality, to media ownership, which Andy's covered so much around Sinclair, you're seeing a legal approach that really starts with, like, let's just tear everything down that the Obama administration did, that we don't really care a lot about what evidence we need to do that. And so you've got, you know, on the one hand, companies going to their investors. I just saw a press release come across my radar that Charter, the big broadband company, you know, is touting publicly that they just invested $21 billion in the last 3 years to upgrade their networks. But they go to the FCC and they say, oh, with these rules, we can't invest. And the FCC just says, oh, great, I found some study that says they're not investing. We'll put that in there. So this is a really shoddy legal document, very much being pushed through. And you've got Ajit Pai running around on sort of a media tour of Fox News, of the Heritage Foundation's webcast, FreedomWorks, and other places, to push this and really ignore any evidence to the contrary and almost not even contend with it in this rulemaking proceeding that they've started.
Well, certainly the clock is still ticking. Any reason to think, because it looks like it's going to be a 3-2 vote, three Republican FCC commissioners, two Democrats. How do you overcome those numbers?
Well, you know, the thing is, you're absolutely right in the whip count, and it's 3-2, and three of them are dyed-in-the-wool Trump appointees who are going to probably vote to get rid of net neutrality. But when you step back a little bit and you look at the larger political fight over net neutrality, the fact is this isn't going to be the last word. And in that larger political picture, the cost of doing this has gone way, way up. Net neutrality is fast becoming one of those third rail issues. I mean, I heard from a Hill office that they were actually getting more calls on net neutrality than they were on taxes. I'm not sure that's a good thing necessarily, but it shows just what a nerve this issue has struck and how many people. We're working with our coalition at battleforthenet.com. More than 600 protests are being organized for December 7th all across the country against what the FCC is doing. So Congress is going to ultimately be involved in this fight. The courts are ultimately going to be involved in this fight. And if the FCC goes forward, they're going to have to defend this decision in court. And when it comes to this kind of rulemaking, a good enough answer for the courts is not, well, we have a new administration and we have a difference of opinion. You actually have to present evidence to make changes to administrative law. You can't be what's called arbitrary and capricious. So Free Press will be part of that lawsuit. We're somewhat confident that we can see these rules that Ajit Pai has put forward overturned. We think eventually Congress, a future Congress, may need to get involved here in this debate, or this one could move to overturn them. So there are a lot of chapters to play out in this debate, and the fact that Ajit Pai is so far out of step with the public, with members of his own party who are 3-1 for net neutrality, suggests to me that this is just not going to be the end.
I guess my surprise is that giants like Google and Apple and Netflix and Amazon and Facebook that are vocal proponents of net neutrality haven't put their shoulders to this more. I guess I was expecting, I don't know, billboards and online ads and such. And I don't see that happening. Do you? Either one, Andy or Craig.
Well, you know, I think what you're seeing is these are big companies, and the bigger you are, maybe the less worried you are about competition online. But to be fair, you know, Netflix has used its public platforms to talk about net neutrality repeatedly this year and in years before. Amazon has put logos on the front of its site urging people to take action. If you go to Reddit today, a huge place on the Internet, you will see net neutrality on the front page all over it. With people telling stories, urging people to take action, and you'll see discussion groups that you would never think talking about this. The number one topic in the Reddit NASCAR group is net neutrality. So this has very much always been driven bottom up, and the companies tend to respond when they hear about it from their customers, their audience, and when they hear it from their own employees. And so one of the great things about this net neutrality fight is that it hasn't actually been led by the big companies, that it's been led by the grassroots, and they may like and want net neutrality, but it's actually far more important to their users and their future competition than it is to, say, Google or Facebook.
Well, Ajit Pai has been very, very busy in addition to net neutrality. He's also been busy giving more power to big media corporations, and that paves the way for even greater media consolidation. Earlier this month, the FCC voted to allow big media companies to add to their media assets. Again, on a 3-2 vote, that 42-year-old ban, it's been around more than four decades, that banned cross-ownership of newspapers and TV stations in media markets in one fell swoop, that's gone. And it seems that the consolidation train is moving so quickly. It's remarkable. Andy, you specifically, Andy Kroll, Mother Jones, you've looked at the Sinclair Broadcasting, what appears to be a media consolidation coup. Can you talk about Sinclair Broadcasting, the nature of that company, and its ties to Donald Trump?
Sinclair is a massive broadcast company, owns and operates more television stations scattered throughout the country than any other broadcast company in America. It is not, though, a well-known company like Fox News or the big television networks, for instance. What Sinclair does is different from a Fox News, where if you're turn on your TV and you want to watch Fox News, you know what channel to go to. You know what you're going to get when you turn on Fox News, their, you know, hard right perspective and presentation of the news 24 hours a day. Sinclair, as I said, owns nearly 200 television stations and operates around the country. And it, you know, it does not broadcast its name into these different television stations. These are people who, when they turn on the television and flip to the local news, they see their local CBS affiliate, their local ABC affiliate. They see the four-letter call sign of their television station. And Sinclair uses these stations around the country to push a conservative, frankly, in a lot of cases, a pro-Trump message through analysis that it films here in the Washington area and then forces out onto its television stations around the country. These are called must-run segments. They employ Boris Epstein, a former Trump administration aide who went right from the Trump White House to Sinclair. He's now their chief political analyst. He basically gets on TV every day and gives a sort of 90-second regurgitation of what President Trump is doing and why it's great and why the American people should support it. So it's a very different model from a Fox News, for instance. Right now, there is a multi-billion-dollar merger pending between Sinclair and Tribune Media. If this deal goes through, if the FCC approves it and the Justice Department approves it, and by all indications it seems like they will, Sinclair would become by far the largest broadcast company in America, would have an incredible amount of influence over the local news that goes into millions and millions of households around the country.
It is extraordinary. A Baltimore Sun columnist wrote that those segments with Boris Epstein that you're referring to, which are, by the way, must runs in all of the Sinclair stations, they have no choice. They have to run those editorial segments from Boris Epstein. The Baltimore Sun columnist wrote, "It's as close to classic propaganda as anything I've seen in broadcast television in the last 30 years. And I think, Craig, Aaron, that the really insidious part potentially is that this is coming from your local news anchors, people you know, you recognize, you may have seen for years, you trust, and yet a new agenda may have just been very quietly slid into those script papers on their desk. To what extent are you concerned about that?
Yeah, I'm hugely concerned about it for exactly what you described, because there are good journalists working at a lot of these Sinclair stations. You know, people are going out and doing their jobs. They're covering local government. They're, you know, doing the traffic, the weather, the sports, all the things that people expect from a local newscast. And yet Sinclair, from the central parts of it in this network, is pushing a clear political agenda. Must run conservative commentary with no other political views represented. Talking points, effectively, as the Baltimore Sun suggests, you know, straight from the White House or straight from the GOP. They're running segments like the terrorism alert desk, which is a bunch of stories that are basically about Muslims having nothing to do with terrorism, but it's all this fear-mongering that is part of their thing. There have been all sorts of things they've been, you know, caught doing, whether it's, you know, doctoring coverage of people protesting police brutality or, you know, slandering people going after Roy Moore in Alabama, not covering the attack on a fellow journalist in Montana by somebody running for Congress. And, you know, the stories just sort of pile up. And what's really dangerous here is you've got a news institution that is going to bat for Donald Trump every day, now coming to Donald Trump's FCC and getting huge, huge policy favors worth billions and billions of dollars that would allow a company like Sinclair to have more than 200 stations to reach 70% of the country. And if they get their way, and if you read their transcripts when they're talking to investors, then they want to start swapping stations and building up regional and local fiefdoms where they control two, three, four stations in a given market, all simulcasting the same content. That is their vision, they are carrying it out, and Donald Trump's FCC is changing the rules right now to let them do this.
And experts say that the FCC is likely to approve this almost $4 billion deal. That means they would now be in the markets of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the nation's three largest media markets. It is just extraordinary. And I don't know, that whole description you just gave made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I'm wondering if, again, in terms of coverage, if journalists are doing enough to sound the alarm on this.
Well, I mean, well, some are. Andy is.
Trying, yeah. I mean, I you know, it's there's this daily challenge nowadays, you know, under the Trump administration, which is, while this is, you know, it's, there has never been a shortage of things to cover being here in Washington under any presidential administration, the Trump administration certainly seems to bring the challenge of staying on top of all the news and making people aware of what's going on here more essential and pressing and wall-to-wall than ever it can feel like. So, no, I don't think there's enough coverage of this, though we're certainly trying here. And, you know, I think there's you know, there are all of these issues underway that while the latest revelation in the Russia investigation is critically important, so is tax policy, so is net neutrality, so is the fate of the broadcast industry and how your local news gets to you. And so I think it's, you know, I am always try to check myself to both see what is dominating the news, what is trending on a particular day, but also to pay as much attention to the stories that are undercovered, but that are important and that bear on, you know, people's everyday lives.
Well, I think we have a couple of minutes left. You want to take, Andy, take maybe 30 seconds. What news are you looking to for next week, the stories you might expect to emerge? Andy?
Oh, I mean, I think there will be more not fallout in a legal sense from the Flynn indictment and plea today, but I think there will be more movement on other administration officials who may be implicated in the details that we saw in the Flynn indictment and, you know, the Trump campaign or administration in waiting's contacts with Russia. I think that will be another part of it. I really do think that, as Craig pointed out very wisely, that this net neutrality is going to be a huge continuing issue, both in terms of the protests, in terms of the debate in Washington. I mean, I did go to the Reddit front page, as Craig mentioned, and it's an absolutely stunning site. I mean, the Reddit is, you know, considered the homepage of the internet. It is, you know, immensely popular, especially among younger generations, and almost every entry on the front page of Reddit, which is, you know, some prime real estate on the internet, is a photo of a senator mm-hmm. with the line, "This is my senator. He sold me, my fellow Hoosiers, and this nation to the telecom lobby for the price of $28,670. That's referring to telecom industry campaign donations.
And Andy Kroll, I'm going to let that do. I'm going to let that do for both you and Craig. Andy Kroll of Mother Jones and Craig Aaron of Free Press and Free Press Action Fund. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's your call.